Day by day, one of the most constant problems that we face is the pull of the world around us to conform to what they say is right and true and good. We teach our children they're not to bow to peer pressure. If people are swearing or drinking and driving or taking drugs or cheating on tests, we teach them that it doesn't matter what they're doing, but to do what they know is right and good. I'm sure we all remember the old line that many parents have used when our kids have come to us and said, "But Dad, Mom, all the kids are doing it." And we reply, "You know, if all the kids ran and jumped off a cliff, does that mean you should do it too?" Peer pressure to get the latest kind of running shoes or a new type of sweater doesn't seem all that bad. But it can be difficult for kids who don't have the family resources to buy all that new stuff. But peer pressure isn't just for teenagers. It hits us every day as well. We call it keeping up with the Joneses. If someone gets a new car or a new house or new golf clubs or even a new spouse, many people feel the pressure to keep pace. All around us, people organize their lives in ways which presuppose that God is dead, or at best, irrelevant. Paul talks to us today about the dangers of peer pressure, of being conformed to the world, which really is a gradual process whereby God and truth and compassion are nudged out of our creative consciousness as a society, and also out of the lives of those who call themselves Christians even. For sure, we struggle hard to keep our faith central to our lives and how we choose to live. But it's so hard when the world around us mocks us for standing up for our principles. It's so hard when those who suck up to the boss, who lie and cheat, who stomp all over whoever is in their way, seem to be the ones who get the job, the promotion, even the girl or the guy. It's hard not to be conformed to the world. After all, we're a part of it, aren't we? But we are also a part of God's kingdom, and God's work is to transform our lives into a reflection of Jesus Christ. When the world tries to numb our minds and spirits to the place where we just follow along with the wisdom of the world, it's so hard to follow God. When we conform, our alertness to evil and lies is gradually disarmed. Our alertness to God and God's presence among us isn't far behind. It's a real threat to the church of the 21st century, as well as to our individual faith journeys, when we as God's people accept without question the dominant intellectual, social, and moral atmosphere of the world around us. Paul wrote that in Jesus Christ, God makes us new people, new creations. We are not to be conformed, we are to be transformed by God's truth and power. And God's call to live out our lives reflecting that truth and power. We are called to live our lives in the power of the resurrection. When we study history or sociology, we see how transient every society has been. Even the powerful empires of Rome and Greece and Britain have all fallen away. Nothing is permanent except God. When we are transformed by God, we are gradually able to see more and more clearly for our own lives what the will of God actually is for us and for our world. We begin to see what is really of worth. What is really good and true, and what is really worth giving our lives to follow. We also begin to see the nature of God's purpose for our lives and for our church. It's a personal obligation on our part to discover and explore the possibilities of the new life that God promises and gives us. But this is certainly not an individual achievement. There can be no lasting peace in our minds and souls except in a new relationship with God, And similarly, there can be no deep sense of satisfaction with our relationship with God unless we have a new relationship with each other. Someone once asked John Wesley, the famous British clergyman and hymn writer, about serving God and going to heaven. Wesley replied, "Sir, you wish to serve God and go to heaven? Remember that you cannot serve him alone. You must therefore find companions or make them. The Bible knows nothing about solitary religion. The new life, the transformed life, is immediately related to community and our responsibilities within that community." So it's no wonder that the premises of Christianity, faith, trust, hope, community, run head on with the me first, looking out for number one, get ahead no matter who gets in your way philosophy of this world. Jesus calls us to treat everyone just as important as we are, to love our neighbor, to forgive when we are wronged. You just can't live like that when everything is me, me, me. So the first step in living a transformed life is to avoid the perils of me, 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 to avoid the trap of pride that believes that we are better or more important than what the reality really is. Do we have a distorted estimate of our worth? We are loved and cherished by God, and God calls us his children. God sends us into the world to show his love. So we are of great worth in the eyes of God. The problem comes when we think that we're the only person that's important. I saw a t-shirt the other day. I thought it was wonderful. I collect t-shirts, but I also like to read t-shirts. This one said, "I'm not arguing with you. I'm just explaining why I'm right." It's a problem when we see others around us only as vehicles for how we can get ahead. We use people around us for our own ends. And even when we do something good for someone, it's often with the wrong motivation. We do it to put them in our debt so that they'll owe us one. And so often we already know what that thing will be. Selfishness and our society go hand in hand, don't they? But selfishness and Jesus don't. James, the brother of Jesus, wrote, "Whenever people are jealous or selfish, they cause trouble and do all sorts of cruel things." If you need any proof, just look at the newspaper if you still have one, or you can go online and check it out. How many examples of selfishness can we find every day? Here's a few that I've seen recently. A teenage girl died in a car wreck. Her boyfriend was challenged to a race on a city street. He took the dare and wrapped the car around a telephone pole. The largest petroleum company in the world filed for bankruptcy some years back. Executives allegedly knew that the ship had big leaks, but told no one until they had time to make some big offshore deposits for themselves. A prominent citizen is put in jail for child pornography. A woman commits murder of the teenage girl who was her daughter's opposition for captain of the school's cheerleading team. That's why Paul writes, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others." At first glance, it seems impossible to live up to, doesn't it? We shouldn't do anything for ourselves. No new clothes, no education savings, no pension plan. Couldn't all these things be considered selfish? At some level, I guess they could, but that's not what Paul was saying. His point was that selfishness is an obsession with self that excludes other people, thus hurting everyone around us. He said, do not merely look out for yourself. He didn't say, don't look out for yourself. You want success? That's great. Don't hurt others getting it. Want to look good? Fantastic. Just don't do it by making others look bad. Because love isn't selfish. I forget what the latest figure is for those who are much braver or crazier than I am and decide that they would like to climb Mount Everest. Last I heard, it was about $75,000. Does that ring true to anybody? So obviously, if you're going to do something like that, it's a bucket list thing. You're not going to try it every year, unless you have a lot more money than I do. This man climbed Mount Everest with his friends. He waited for years. He trained and trained. He saved his money. And finally, the big day arrived. As they climbed and climbed, he felt wonderful about his experience and his adventure. He was within sight of the top when he saw a man shivering over the side of the path. He had been given up for dead. No one had seen him for days. What would he do? He stopped and he helped. He warmed the man and then took him back down the mountain, giving up on his dream. It's easy for us to fall into the same trap of the religious guy that Jesus talked about in our reading today. He prayed, God, I thank you that the world has people like me. The man on the corner needs welfare, I don't. The prostitute on the street has AIDS, I don't. The drunk at the bar needs alcohol? I don't. I thank you that the world has people like me. Fortunately, there was a person standing by who got it. He prayed, God, have mercy on me because I am a sinner. Like my brother on welfare, I'm dependent on your grace. Like my sister with AIDS, I'm infected with my mistakes. Like my friend who drinks, I need something to ease my pain. And as you love and give grace to these, please grant some to me as well. Have mercy on me. As much as God hates the arrogance of the first prayer, God loves the humility of the second prayer. So here are a couple of tips as we work on all this for ourselves. Assess yourself honestly. Humility is not the same thing as low self-esteem. Being humble doesn't mean that you don't have something to offer. It means you know exactly what you have to offer, and you do it. Don't cherish exaggerated ideas of yourself or your own importance, said Paul. A tough lesson for us all. Then don't take success too seriously. In Deuteronomy it's written, when your silver and gold increase, your heart will become proud. Counteract this tendency by reminding yourself how fragile wealth is, how short life is. You can't take your success or your money with you. Then celebrate the significance of other people. They're just as important in God's eyes as you are. Sports columnist Rick Riley gave this advice to rookie professional athletes, football players. He said, stop thumping your chests. But remember, the line blocked well, the quarterback threw a perfect pass while getting his head knocked off, and the really good receiver was covered by three guys. It's not all about you. Really, every touchdown or goal in life is a team effort. Applaud your teammates. A little boy came home from school after tryouts for the school play. His mom knew he didn't have a whole lot of talent and said, Mommy, so excited. He said, I got the part. I've been chosen to sit in the audience and clap and cheer. When you have a chance to clap and cheer for others, do you take it? Don't demand your own parking spot. Demanding respect is like chasing a butterfly. If you chase it, you'll never catch it. Sit still and it may light on your shoulder. I love the story from Big Bang where Sheldon accuses his friend Howard of stealing his parking spot. And Howard said, the university gave it to me because it hasn't been used for 10 years. He said, well, it's my spot. He said, but you don't have a car and you don't drive. So why do you need a parking spot? It's my parking spot. We need to move back behind and beyond that kind of thinking. Speak humbly. Don't be cocky. People aren't necessarily impressed with your opinions, especially if you keep giving them on everything. Then live your life at the foot of the cross. Paul wrote that the cross of Jesus was his only reason for bragging. Do you feel a need for affirmation? Does your self-esteem need some work? You don't need to drop names to show off. You only need to pause at the foot of the cross and be reminded of this. The maker of the heavens and the earth would rather die for you than live without you. And that is a fact. We are important. We're not essential. We're valuable, but not indispensable. We have a part in the play, but we're not the main act. We have a song to sing, but we're not the featured voice. God is. God did well enough before we were born, and he'll do fine when we're gone. He started it all, sustains it all, and will bring it all to a glorious climax one day. In the meantime, we have this wonderful privilege to surrender our personal Everest, discover the joy and the thrill of going the extra mile for another person, doing deeds for which we can't be repaid, seek problems that others would avoid, and deny ourselves, pick up our crosses, and follow Jesus. Lincoln Hall was the man who was freezing at the side of the path. He survived his trip down Mount Everest, thanks to a guy who gave up his dream, Dan Mazur. He lived to be reunited with his wife and sons in New Zealand. A television reporter asked Lincoln's wife what she thought of his rescuers, the men who surrendered their mountaintop experience to save her husband's life. She tried to answer, but the words just stuck in her throat. After several moments and with tear-filled eyes, she spoke, "Well, there's one amazing human being," she said, "and the other men with him. The world needs more people like that." And that's what Jesus is trying to tell us today. Amen.